they started a new spell, they were starting over from scratch. They didn't see the connections between them. And you could forget about doing any original work, which Julia was already looking forward to. Along with Jared, she started an ancient languages working group. They only got 4 other members, and most of those were there because Julia was hot. She kicked them out one by one when they didn't keep up with the homework. As for the hand exercises, she worked doubly hard at those, because she knew she wasn't naturally gifted at them. Nobody kept up with her on the hand exercises, not even Jared. They didn't have her taste for pain. Much as she hated breakbills, with a red glowing hatred that she kept carefully burning in some inner brazier, blowing on it if it ever sank too low, she could see why they kept things exclusive there. A lot of riffraff came through the Troop Avenue safe house. Julia had always had a nasty competitive streak. In the past, she'd done her best to keep it under wraps. Now, she reversed that policy. With no one to check her, she nurtured it and let it flower. As breakbills had humiliated her, so she would humiliate anybody who couldn't keep up with her. Hey, magic's not a popularity contest. Troop Avenue would be her own private breakbills. Any visitor who came to the Troop Avenue safe house rocking a level equal to or less than Julia's had better come to play. Any bullshit you were walking around with, you would be called on. It didn't matter if you were black or white or tired or sick or 12. It was amazing, truly incredible, how many magicians were faking their way through this shit. It made Julia furious. Who issued these people their stars? You gave some of these other safe houses a little push and they fell over like houses of cards. It was dispiriting, is what it was. She'd finally found a magic school of sorts to call her very own, and it was barfing out a bunch of fakers and cheats. On the strength of Julia's bedside manner, the Troop Avenue safe house began to get a bit of a reputation. They didn't get quite so many drop-ins anymore, and some of the drop-ins they did get got ugly, as in physical. Bullshitters don't like being called on their bullshit, and there was a considerable Venn diagram overlap between people who were into magic and people who were into martial arts. But I'm sorry, where did you think you were, motherfucker? Connecticut? You're in a magic safe house in Bed-Stuy, borough of Brooklyn. There was a considerable Venn diagram overlap between people who lived in Bed-Stuy and people who had motherfucking guns. Fool, welcome to New Dork City. Still, even with Julia's crusade for magical rigor bringing up the general tone of things, there was a problem at the Bed-Stuy safe house, and that was its 3-ring binder, the spell binder. Every once in a while, a visitor would drop by who meant business, and they'd know a spell that wasn't in the book. And if that was the case, and if the book contained a spell that they didn't know, a swap might be arranged, and the book would grow. But such transactions were frustratingly infrequent. Julia needed to grow faster than that. It didn't make sense. Where did these spells come from in the first place? What was the source? Nobody knew. Turnover was high at safe houses, and institutional memory was short. But more and more, Julia suspected that somebody out there was operating on a much higher level than she was, and she wanted to know who, and where, and how, and now. So Julia turned it around. She became a visitor. She'd hung on to the Civic from her Chesterton days, and she quit her job troubleshooting networks and started putting miles on it, sometimes by herself, sometimes with Jared riding shotgun. Safe houses weren't easy to find. They hid their locations from the wider world, but also from one another, because safe houses had been known to go to war, and that usually resulted in mutual annihilation. But sometimes you could coax an address out of a friendly visitor. She'd gotten good at coaxing. If all else failed, she had the power of the bathroom hand job, and she wielded it with an iron fist. And some safe houses were bigger than others, and some were big enough and safe enough that they'd allowed themselves to get a little famous, at least within the scene, on the strength of their belief that they were big enough that nobody could fuck with them. The binder she was handed in an old repurposed bank building in Buffalo was so thick it made her fall on her knees and weep. She stayed there for a week, uploading magical knowledge into her starving brain by the terabyte. All that summer she roamed north into Canada, west as far as Chicago, south to Tennessee and Louisiana, and all the way down to Key West, a back-breaking, clutch-grinding, vinyl-sticky trip that yielded a face-palmingly disappointing 12-page spellbook in a cat-infested bungalow next door to the Hemingway home. It was Julia's wandering period. She crashed on spare beds and in motels and in the Civic. When the Civic quit on her, she got into knot-wiring cars off the street. She met a lot of people, and some people who weren't people. The more rural houses occasionally played host to minor demons and lesser fairies and local geospecific nature spirits and elementals who lent street cred to the establishment in return for God knows what in the way of goods and services she didn't ask. There was a certain romance to these beings. They seemed to embody the very promise of magic, which was to deliver unto her a world greater than the one into which she had been born. The moment when you walk into a room and the guy playing pool has a pair of red leather wings sticking out of his back, and the chick smoking on the balcony has eyes of liquid golden fire, at that moment you think you'll never be sad or bored or lonely again. But Julia got to the bottom of those beings pretty fast, and once she got there, she often found someone who was just as desperate and confused as she was. That was how Julia got mixed up with Warren, and that was the lesson she learned. At any rate, her back was filling up with seven-pointed stars. She had to put the big 50 spot on her neck to save space. It was unconventional, but conventions were there to make it easy on the fakers and cheats. You had to bend conventions to make room for somebody like Julia. But Julia was running out of steam. She was a freight train of magical pedagogy, but that train ran on information, new data, and fuel was growing scarce, and what there was wasn't of the best quality. The potatoes were too small. Every time she walked into a new safe house, she did so with her hopes high, but her hopes were dashed more and more often. It went like this. She pushed open the door, accepted the ogling gazes of the local males, showed off her stars, intimidated the ranking officer into showing her the binder, which she leafed through listlessly, expecting to find and finding nothing she didn't already know, whereupon she dropped the binder on the floor and walked out, letting Jared make her apologies for her. This was bad behavior, and she knew it. She did it because she was angry and because she disliked herself. The more she disliked herself, the more she took it out on other people, and the more she took it out on other people, the more she disliked herself. There's your proof, Mr. Hofstadter. I am a strange loop. Sure, she could have lit out for the West Coast or made a run for the Mexican border, but she had a feeling she already knew what she would find there. In the looking-glass world of the great magical underground, perspective appeared to be reversed. The closer you got to things, the smaller they looked. Objects in mirror were farther away than they appeared. Put another way, how many coin flips could one girl predict? How many nails could she protect from rust? The world was not in urgent need of more demagnetized magnets. This was magic, but it was chicken shit magic. She had tuned in to the choir invisible, and it was singing game show jingles. She'd put her entire life down as a deposit on this stuff, and it was starting to look like she'd been taken. After all she'd been through, all she'd sacrificed, that was more than she could stand. She wondered for a while if Jared could be holding out on her, if he knew something she didn't. But she was pretty sure that wasn't the case. Just to make sure, she deployed the nuclear option. Nope. Zero. Oh well. To be absolutely honest, she'd deployed the nuclear option a few times on her travels, and she was starting to feel a bit like a nuclear wasteland herself, irradiated and toxic. She didn't like to think about it. She didn't even name it to herself. Nuclear was the code word, and she kept those memories encoded, never to be decrypted. She'd done what she had to do. That was the end of it. She no longer even fantasized about real love. She couldn't imagine it anymore. her and it being in the same world. She'd given it up for magic. But nuclear winter was coming, and magic wasn't keeping her warm. It was getting cold, tainted snow was falling, and the earth was getting thirsty again, thirsty for balm. The black dog was hunting. Julia was feeling it again, the blackness. Or really, blackness would have been a relief. Blackness would have been a field trip compared with where she was headed, which was despair. That stuff had no color. She wished it were made of blackness, velvety, soft blackness, that she could curl up and fall asleep in. But it was so much worse than that. Think of it as the difference between zero and the empty set, the set that contains nothing, not even zero. These but the trappings and the suits of woe. All these seem to laugh, compared with me who am their epitaph. December came, and the days shortened, snow quietened the traffic on Troop Avenue. And then one day, St. Lucy's Day, as it should happen, the day of the Dunn poem, it all went down. And when it did, it went down Western style. A stranger came to town. She had a nice look about her, the stranger, an Ivy League look. 29, maybe, dark suit, dark hair pulled back and secured with crossed chopsticks, a round face, baby fat, nerd glasses, but hard. There might once have been a time when she was pushed around, but that time was long past. As per Troop Avenue protocol, as soon as she was in the door, the big gun stepped to her. The big gun being Julia. Well, Ivy League took off her jacket and unbuttoned her cuffs. Both arms were sleeved in stars up to the shoulders. She spread them wide, in the manner of our Savior, to show a 100 spot on the inside of each wrist. The room got very quiet. Julia showed Ivy League her stars. Then Ivy League made her prove it. This had never happened to Julia before, but she knew the drill. She would have to walk through every spell she knew, every test she'd ever passed, to satisfy Ivy that she had earned her stars. Step by step, level by level, coins, nails, fires, magnets, the whole utility belt from level 1 to level 77, which was as far as Julia had gotten. It took 4 hours while the sun set and the short-timers and day students went home. Of course, Julia lived for this shit. She only flubbed a couple in the mid-50s, but the bylaws allowed her a few retakes, and she got through it, shaking, but still fierce. Whereupon Ivy League nodded coldly, rolled down her sleeves, put her jacket back on, and left. It took all of Julia's pride not to run after her, shouting, "Take me with you, mysterious stranger!" She knew who that must have been. That was one of the others, the people who had a line on real magic, the pure shit. Ivy League had been to the source where the spells came from. Julia had known they were out there just by the way they perturbed the universe like a black planet, and she'd been right. Finally, they'd shown themselves to her. They'd tested her. And just as Breakbills had, they'd found her wanting. There must be a flaw in her, one that she couldn't see, but obvious to those who looked for it. It wasn't till she got home that she found the card in her pocket. It was blank, but a complex unlocking enchantment revealed a message printed on it in Old Church Slavonic. "Burn this." She burned it in an ashtray, using not a simple conflagration spell, but rather the 43rd level one, which did basically the same thing, but did it in 14th position and in Old Church Slavonic. The flame flashed violet and orange, rhythmically. The flashes were Morse code. The Morse code spelled out a pair of GPS coordinates, which turned out to correspond to a microscopic hamlet in the south of France. The hamlet was called Mur. It was all very free trader Beowulf. At last Julia had been called. The fat envelope had arrived. This time she was really going. She had put down her bet a long time ago, and finally, finally, it was showing signs of paying off. How to explain all this to her parents, who you would have thought would have been way past caring? She was 22 now. How many times were these people going to make her break their hearts? But as much as she dreaded the conversation, it went better than she expected. She hid a lot from her parents, but one thing she couldn't hide from them was that she actually felt hopeful for once. She believed that she had a shot at happiness now, and she was taking it. It seemed like it was years since she'd felt that way. Her parents understood that somehow, and they weren't upset. They were happy for her. They let her go. Speaking of letting people go, she dumped owlish Jared, the not-so-cunning linguist, on his pale and bony ass. "Call me when you finish that dissertation, pork pie." One fine day in April, Julia boarded a plane, bringing with her none of her worldly possessions, and flew to Marseille, on the lurid blue Mediterranean Sea. She felt so light and free, she could have flown there under her own power. She rented a Peugeot that she would never return, and drove north for an hour, negotiating a typically French rond-point every 100 meters, turned right at Cavaillon, and got lost 80 times near Gourdes, a spectacular village perché that clung vertiginously to the side of the Luberon Valley as if it had been plastered there with a trowel. She rolled into sleepy, tiny Mur at 3 in the afternoon, in the heart of photogenic Provence. And lo and behold, it was a little gym, a largely untouristed clump of old houses built from strangely light-emitting, bleached brown, southern French stone. It had one church and one castle and one hotel. The streets were medieval and paint-scrapingly narrow. Julia stopped the car in the town square and took in the heartbreaking World War I memorial. Half of the dead had the same last name. The GPS coordinates were 10 minutes outside of town. They corresponded to a handsome farmhouse, afloat all by itself in a sea of hay and lavender fields. It had sky-blue shutters and a white gravel driveway in which she parked her scraped-up Peugeot. A clean-cut man, only a little older than Julia, answered the door. He was handsome. You got the impression that he hadn't always been clean-cut, that he'd lost a lot of weight at some point in his life. It had left behind some interesting lines on his face.
"Hello, Circe," he said. "I'm Pouncy Silver Kitten. Welcome home."
Chapter 19. Standing at the bow with Elliot the next morning, two kings of Fillory plowing eastward into the unknown, into the rising sun, never knowing what god or fate or magic was going to send rearing up at them over the horizon next. This, now. This was much more like it. This was the stuff. At first it had been hard to admit it, to change gears again and just go with it, but then suddenly it wasn't. Not with the morning sun on his face and the muntjac surging and galloping along under him. He'd missed a lot here, but he wasn't going to miss anything more. Earth was the dream, not Fillory. And it was going to that part of his brain where dreams went, the kind of anxiety-ridden, fiendishly detailed dreams that felt like they lasted for years through endless, meaningless plot twists, which deliver you ultimately to a fate not even of death, but merely of permanent embarrassment. Fillory had taken him back. Welcome to the quest for the 7 keys. Your adventure is already in progress. Bingle was atop the forecastle, as usual, just like back in the day, but now he was sparring vigorously with another swordsman. It was Benedict, stripped to the waist, lean and brown, grimacing as he gave ground and then, unbelievably, beating Bingle back and pressing his advantage. The whole time he kept his wrist on his hip, swashbuckler style. The air rang with the loud scraping of steel on steel, like the gnashing of a huge pair of scissors. Their swords locked. Stalemate. They broke apart, clapping each other on the shoulder and laughing, laughing about some point of technical swordsmanship. It was like watching an alternate timeline version of himself, a timeline in which he'd stayed in Fillory and learned to hold his sword at full extension for more than 2 minutes. Quentin caught Benedict's eye, and Benedict saluted him, smiling with those bright white teeth. Quentin saluted back. They squared off again. Bingle had found his disciple.
"Those guys are amazing."
He hadn't heard Poppy come up beside him. She was watching the action, too.
"Can you do that?"
she asked. "Are you kidding?" Poppy shook her head. She was not kidding. "I wish I could. The one on the right, the older guy, he's the best swordsman in Fillory. We had a contest."
"It all still looks like a movie to me. I can't believe it's all real. Wow!"
Bingle did one of his signature gymnastic tumbling passes.
"Oh, my God, I thought he was going over the side."
"I know. I was going to take lessons with him."
"That sounds exciting. What happened?"
"I accidentally went back to the real world. Then a year went by here in 3 days."
"Well, I can see now why you wanted to come back. It's beautiful here. I'm sorry I thought it was funny before. I was wrong."
Quentin had expected Poppy to be miserable on board the Muntjac. After all, she'd effectively been abducted from everything she knew and cared about and brought here. It was an outrage to every principle she lived by. And all that was true, and she'd spent a day being outraged about it. Well, half a day. Poppy had spent yesterday afternoon sulking. Then she showed up at breakfast this morning with a brand new can-do attitude. She just wasn't temperamentally suited to long-haul sulking. Sure, all right. She'd been accidentally transported to a magical world that until recently she had understood to be fictional. The situation wasn't ideal, but it was what she had to work with, so she would work with it. She was a tough one, Poppy.
"I talked to the other one at dinner last night," she said. "The kid, Benedict. He's a big fan of yours."
"Benedict? Really?
Did you see how he lit up when he saw you watching him just now? Look at him. He's killing himself to impress you. You're a father figure for him."
Quentin hadn't seen. How was Poppy here for 1 day, and she'd seen all that? "To be honest, I always thought he hated me."
"He's gutted he didn't get to go to Earth with you."
"You must be joking. And miss out on all the adventures here?" Now Poppy directed her guileless blue gaze at him instead of the sword fight.
"What makes you think what happened to you on Earth wasn't an adventure?"
Quentin started to answer and stopped, with his mouth open, because it turned out he had nothing to say. It was 5 more days before they sighted land. They were having breakfast al fresco on deck, Quentin, Elliot, Josh, and Poppy. It was a practice Elliot had instituted. The crew set up a table on the poop deck with a blinding white tablecloth clipped on to keep it from blowing away. He kept this up in a surprising range of meteorological conditions. Once Quentin saw him up there alone in a squall, munching on marmalade toast that was obviously soaked through with salt spray. It was a matter of principle with him. But today it was nice out. The weather was almost tropical again. Sunlight flashed off the silverware, and the sky was a perfect blue dome. Though the food itself was getting pretty grim, the kind of unspoilable stuff that came out of deep storage late in an ocean voyage, hard biscuits and meat so salty it was more salt than meat. The only thing that was still good was the jam. Quentin used a lot of it.
"So this is how it works," he said. "The questing? We just keep sailing east till we hit something?"
"Unless you have a better idea," Elliot said. "No, just remind me why we think it's going to work."
"Because that's how quests always work," Elliot said.
"I don't pretend to understand the mechanics of it, but the lesson seems to be that you just can't force the issue with a whole lot of detective work. It's a waste of energy. The ones who go around knocking on doors and looking for clues never find the thing, the grail or whatever it is, It's more a matter of having the right attitude.
What attitude is that?
Elliot shrugged.
I haven't got a clue. I guess we're supposed to have faith.
I never really took you for the faith-having kind, Quentin said. I didn't either, but it's worked out so far. We've got 5 of the 7 keys. You can't argue with results.
You can't, Quentin said. But that's actually not the same thing as having faith.
Why do you always try to ruin everything?
I'm not ruining it. I just want to understand it. If you had faith, you wouldn't have to understand.
And why exactly are you looking for these keys?
Poppy asked brightly.
Or I guess, why are we looking for them?
Yeah, why are we? Josh said. I mean, don't get me wrong, they're cool and all. They sound cool. Can I see them?
We don't really know why, Elliot said. The unique beasts wanted us to find them.
But find them and do what with them? Poppy said.
I suppose once we have them all, they'll tell us. Or perhaps we'll know when we have them. Or perhaps we'll never know.
They might just take the keys and pat us on the behind and send us on our way. I don't know. I've never done a quest before.
So, the journey is the arrival kind of thing? Josh said. I hate that stuff. I'm an old-fashioned arrival is the arrival kind of guy.
For what it's worth, they told me the realm was in peril, Elliot said. So there is that, but it's not like the Holy Grail was actually useful for anything.
I told everybody the Nidorlands are jacked, right? Josh said.
You think that's part of this? Quentin said. You think they're connected?
No.
Well, maybe.
Josh stroked his chin with his thumb and forefinger.
But how?
The Nidorlands are down, Quentin ticked them off. Jollibee is dead. The realm is supposedly in peril. 7 golden keys. A dragon collecting buttons. If there's a thread running through all that, I'm not seeing it.
Maybe he didn't want to see it.
That would be a hell of a thread.
You'd want to think twice about yanking on it. Someone up in the rigging shouted that he could see an island.
The boat's prow scrunched almost soundlessly into the damp white sand. Quentin vaulted over the bow just as it spent the very last of its momentum and landed on his feet on powdery white sand with his boots still dry. He turned back toward the launch, bowed, and received a smattering of applause from its passengers. He grabbed the painter and hauled on it as the others, Elliot, Josh, Poppy, Julia, Bingle, Benedict, scrambled out on both sides. The air was quiet and still. It felt weird to be standing on solid ground again.
"Worst away team ever," Josh said, wading up onto land. "Not a single red shirt."
"Pretty." That was the impression the island had made from a distance. Chalk cliffs that parted to reveal a small bay with a tidy beach. A row of single trees stood out against the skyline, so fine and still and green against the blue sky, they looked like they'd been carved in jade. Vacation paradise. It was late afternoon. It had taken them most of the day to make landfall. They stood together on shore in a knot. The sand was as clean as if it had been sifted. Quentin slogged across it and up the first dune to the crest to see what was beyond it. The dune was steep, and just short of the top, he flopped down on the slope and peered over the crest. It was like being a kid at the beach. Beyond the dune were more dunes topped with scrub, then a meadow, then a line of trees. Then Ember knew what else. So far, so good. Pretty.
"Welp," Quentin said, "let's get questin'." But first there were more mundane matters to attend to. Quentin and Poppy and Josh had been in Venice 3 days ago, but this was the first land the men had seen in something like 3 weeks. They piled ashore in 2s and 3s, some of them cannonballed off the Muntjac's sides into the flat green sea. After a suitable interval for goofing off, Elliot mustered them on the shore and sent them out in teams to find fresh water,
gather wood for fires and new spars, set up tents, harvest the local fruit, hunt for local game.
"We've fallen on our feet," Elliot said, once everybody had a job to do. "Don't you think? So far, I would rate this an above-average island."
"It's so beautiful," Poppy said. "Do you think anybody lives here?"
Elliot shook his head.
"I don't know. We're 2 months' sail out from Castle Whitespire. I've never heard of anyone else coming this far. We could be the first human beings ever to set foot here."
"Think of that," said Quentin.
"So do you want to..."
"What?"
"You know, claim it for Fillory."
"Oh,"
Elliot considered.
"We haven't been doing that. It seems a little imperialist. I'm not sure it's in good taste."
"But haven't you always wanted to say it?"
"Well, yes," Elliot said. "All right. We can always give it back."
He raised his voice, using the one he used to call meetings to order back at Castle Whitespire.
"I, High King Elliot, hereby claim this island for the great and glorious kingdom of Fillory. Henceforth it will be known as..." He paused. "As New Hawaii."
Everybody nodded vaguely.
"New Hawaii?" Quentin said. "Really?"
"It's not really tropical," Poppy said. "The vegetation's more temperate."
"What about far-flung island?" Quentin said. "Like as one word, far-flung."
"Relief island,"
Poppy was getting into the spirit of it.
"White sand island. Green grass island."
"Skull island," Josh said. "No, wait, spider skull island."
"Okay, the island to be named later," Elliot said. "Come on, let's find out what's on it before we name it."
But by then the sun was low in the sky, so instead they pitched in bringing sticks and dry grass back from the meadow. With 5 trained magicians on hand, starting a fire wasn't a problem. They could have made a fire with just sand, but it wouldn't have smelled as good. The hunting party came back flushed with pride, hauling 2 wild goats on their shoulders, and one of the foragers had spotted a patch of something very closely analogous to carrots growing wild at the edge of the woods that seemed self-evidently safe to eat. They all sat in circles on the cooling sand, the cold sea air at their backs, the warmth of the fire on their faces, and savored the feeling of being on firm ground again, with enough space to stretch out their arms and legs and not touch anything or anybody. The beach was covered with footprints now, and as the sun got lower, the light made monkey puzzle shadow patterns on it. They were very far from home. The setting sun moved behind a cloud, lighting it up from the inside like a pall of smoke, sunlight leaking out around the edges. Strange stars came swarming across the blackening sky. No one wanted to get back on the Muntjac, not yet. So when the light was all gone, the travelers wrapped themselves up in blankets right there on the sand and fell asleep. The next day, everything seemed a little less urgent than it had when they first arrived. Yes, the realm was in peril, but was it in immediate peril? It was hard to imagine a place that felt less imperiled than the island to be named later. There was a touch of Lotus Land about it. And anyway, adventure would find them when it was ready, or so the theory ran. You couldn't rush it. You just had to keep the right state of mind. For now, they would savor the anticipation and stay well rested. Even Julia wasn't pushing.
"I was afraid we would not get back," she said. "Now I am afraid of what will happen if we go forward."
They hiked up to the top of the cliffs on one side of the bay, and from there got a good look at Moore Green Island, with rocky hills heaped up in the interior. Birds roosted along the cliff tops in bunches. They had dull gray feathers on their backs and wings, but they had a way of turning in the air in unison and suddenly showing you their rose-colored chests all at once. Quentin was going to name them rose-breasted swoopers or something along those lines when Poppy pointed out that they already had a name. They were galas. They had them in Australia, too. The cook was a keen fisherman, and he pulled a prodigious number of fat, tiger-striped fish out of the surf, one after the other. In the afternoon, Quentin watched Benedict and Bingle fence with foils. They stuck wine corks on the tips for safety. He spent an hour just lying back on his elbows and looking at the waves. They were nothing like the brutally cold, Puritan waves of his East Coast youth, which had sternly discouraged anything so frivolous as surfing or frolicking. These waves came sloping in smoothly, building up heads of boiling cream foam on top, reared up for a moment, mint green and paper thin in the sunlight, then broke in a long line with a sound like fabric tearing. He wiggled his toes in the hot sand and watched the weird moiré optical effects that the miniature sand avalanches created. They went to bed that night, hardly having explored more than the thin crescent of island they'd already seen. Tomorrow they would strike inland, into the forest and up into the hills. Quentin woke early. The sun wasn't even up yet, though there was a gray blur of pre-dawn to the east. He wondered what happened out there to the extreme east. The rules were different in Fillory. For all he knew, the world was flat, and the sun ran on tracks. Everything was gray, the sand, the trees, the sea. Deep red embers smoldered under the gray ashes of the bonfires. It was warm out. The sleepers on the beach looked as though they had fallen there from a great height. Poppy had kicked off her blanket. She slept with her arms crossed over her chest like a knight on a tomb. He would have gone back to sleep, but he was dying for a piss. He got up and jogged to the top of the dune and down the other side. It didn't seem quite far enough for hygienic purposes, so he went one farther, and at that point he figured he might as well get as far as the field and pee there. It was undeniably a vulnerable feeling as he let fly into the tall grass, but the morning was as still as a painting, and they hadn't been completely stupid about it. Anybody who knew the proper reveal spells, meaning almost no one, would have seen a gossamer-thin line of magical force, pale blue in color, looped along the edge of the forest like a tripwire. They'd set it up the day before. It wouldn't hurt anybody who walked into it, not permanently, but the magicians would know they were there, and they wouldn't be walking anymore. They'd be lucky if they were conscious. They'd already caught a wild pig that way. Even the insects were hushed. Quentin sneezed. He was mildly allergic to some local plant, and wiped his eyes. On the far side of the meadow, something slipped into the forest. It went just as his eye began to track it. It must have been standing there, stock still, watching him while he pissed. He got an impression of something large, the size of a big boar, maybe. Quentin fastened his trousers. Zippers were foreign to Fillory, and so far impossible to reverse engineer. You just couldn't explain them to the dwarves. And walked across the meadow to where the animal had been. Standing just on the near side of the blue line, he peered in among the trees. They were thick enough that it was still full night in the forest. Still, he caught the faintest shadow of a pair of heavy animal haunches receding into it. "Is this it? Is it starting?" Carefully, like he was stepping over an electric fence, he put one leg over the invisible blue line, then the other, and walked into the forest. He was pretty sure he knew who he was chasing, even before he was fully in view. "Hey, Ember," he called. "Ember, wait up." The god looked at him impassively over his shoulder, then continued to trot. "Oh, come on." The ram god had not been seen in Fillory since the Brakebills took the thrones, or not as far as Quentin knew. He looked fully recovered from the beating he'd taken from Martin Chatwin. Even his hind leg, which had been crippled the last time Quentin saw him, was restored and could take his weight without a limp. Quentin had complicated feelings about Ember. He wasn't like Ember was in the books. Quentin was still angry that he hadn't been able to save them. To save Alice. In the fight against Martin. He supposed it wasn't Ember's fault, but still. What kind of a god wasn't at the top of the food chain in his own world? The big woolly kind with horns, apparently. Quentin didn't have any particular beef with Ember. He just didn't want to bow down to him the way he always seemed to expect people to do. If Ember was so great, he should have saved Alice, and if he wasn't that great, Quentin wasn't bowing, QED. Still, if Ember was here, it meant they were on the right track. Things were going to get very real soon, or at least very Fillorian. He just didn't know which Fillory it was going to be, the beautiful magical Fillory or the dark, frightening one. Either way, this would be a good moment for a shipment of divine wisdom to arrive, guidance from on high, a pillar of fire, a tree of smoke. Ember led Quentin uphill into the interior of the island. Quentin was starting to get winded. After 5 minutes, Ember finally slowed down enough to let him catch up. By that time they were halfway up a hill, and the sun had at last pushed a hot pink sliver of itself up over the horizon. They were high enough that Quentin could look out across the forest canopy. "Thanks," Quentin said, taking big, heaving breaths. "Jesus." He leaned on Ember's flank for a second, before wondering if maybe that was too familiar, mortal to God. "Hi, Ember. How's it going?"
"Hello, my child."
That resonant bass voice instantly sent Quentin right back to the cavern under Ember's tomb. He hadn't heard it since then, and his guts clenched. That was not a place he wanted to go back to. He would keep the tone light.
"Fancy meeting you here." "We do not meet by chance. Nothing happens by chance."
"That was Ember for you. No small talk." The ram began to climb again. Quentin wondered if he knew that behind his back, Quentin and the others called him Rambo, and, less kindly, Member. "No, I guess not," Quentin said, though he wasn't actually sure that he agreed. "So, how did you get all the way out here?"
"Fillory is my realm, child. I am everywhere, and therefore anywhere."
"I see that. But couldn't you just have magicked us here, instead of making us sail all this way?"
"I could have. I did not."
"Forget it." Quentin could look back now and see the Muntjac at anchor, neat and perfect. You could have put it in a bottle. He could even see the camp on the beach, the bonfires and blankets. But there was no time to admire the view. The ram was taking the rocky slopes of the hill at speed, which was fine for him. He was built for it. He was a ram. Quentin panted and eyed the fluffy, pale gold wool on his broad back and wondered if Ember would let him ride on him. Probably not. "You know," Quentin went on, "while I've got you, I've been wondering about these seven keys. If you're basically omnipresent and probably omniscient, too, why don't you go around and just collect the keys yourself? If they're so important to the realm, I mean, you could probably do it in half an hour, tops."
"There is deeper magic at work here, my child. Even the gods must bow to it. That is the way."
"Oh, right, the deeper magic. I forgot about that." The deeper magic always seemed to come up when Ember didn't feel like doing something or needed to close a plot hole.
"I do not think you understand, my child. There are things that a man must do, that a god may not. He who completes a quest does not merely find something. He becomes something."
Quentin stopped, blowing, hands on hips. The horizon to the east was a solid band of orange now. The stars were going out. "What's that? What does he become?"
"A hero, Quentin."
The ram kept going, and he followed.
"Fillory has need of gods and kings and queens, and those it has. But it has need of a hero, too. And it has need of the seven keys."
Fillory doesn't ask for much, does it?
Fillory asks for everything.
With a lumbering lunge, awkward but powerful, Ember surged ahead and surmounted a rocky dome that turned out to be the top of the hill. From there, he turned his head and looked down at Quentin with his strange, peanut-shaped eyes. Supposedly, sheep evolved that way so they could see wolves coming out of the corners of their eyes, better peripheral vision. But the effect was disconcerting.
That's a big ask.
Fillory asks for what it needs.
Do you, Quentin? What do you need? What do you ask for?
The question stopped him. He was used to scolding and pseudo-Socratic interrogation from Ember, but here was a rare gem, a good question. What did he want? He'd wanted to get back to Fillory, and he'd done that. He thought he wanted to get back to Castle Whitespire, but now he wasn't so sure. The terror of almost losing Fillory had been extreme, but he'd found his way back. Now he wanted to find the keys. He wanted to finish the quest. He wanted his life to be exciting and important, and to mean something. And he wanted to make Julia better. He felt like he would do anything to help Julia, if he only knew what to do.
I guess it's like what you said, Quentin said. I want to be a hero.
Ember turned away again and faced the rising sun.
Then you will have your chance, he said.
Quentin scrambled up onto the rocky summit and watched the dawn alongside him. He was going to ask Ember about it, about the sun and what it was, and what happened out there at the rim of the world, or whether Fillory even had a rim. But when he turned to ask him, he was alone on top of the hill. Ember was gone.
Just when things were getting interesting,
he turned slowly in a full circle, but there was no sign of him. Vanished without a trace. Oh, well. Now that he was gone, Quentin almost missed him. There was something special about being in the divine presence, even when the divinity was Ember. He stretched, standing at the top of the island, and then jumped carefully down from the rocks and began trotting back down the hill to the beach. He couldn't wait to tell the others what had happened, though the whole thing already felt like a dream, an early morning, half-awake dream, tangled up with sheets and pillows and dawn light through closed curtains, the kind you only remembered by chance hours later, for a few seconds when you were going to sleep again, at the end of the day. He wondered if anyone else was up yet. Maybe he could still go back to bed. He should have noticed that something had changed, but he'd been distracted on the way up. He'd been practically running, plus he'd been talking to a god, and he'd never been an especially assiduous observer of flora and fauna. He wouldn't have noticed a spectacular beech tree or an unusual elm because he didn't know what the difference between them was, if any. Still, after a few minutes, he began to wonder if he was coming down a different way than he'd come up, because it all seemed a little rockier than he remembered. The ratio of rocks to plants and dirt to grass wasn't quite what it had been. He didn't let it worry him too much, because if it worried him too much, he would have to climb back up the hill and find a new way down, and that was the kind of thing he wanted to avoid. And besides, he was keeping the rising sun on his right hand, and that's how navigation works, right? If things really went wrong, he could go all the way down to the beach and cut along the coast. No way he could miss the camp that way. He still had hopes of getting back to the beach in time for breakfast. One thing he couldn't ignore, though, although he tried to for as long as he could, was that the shadows of things weren't getting shorter anymore in the usual manner of shadows cast by a rising sun. They were getting longer, which would have meant that the orange-red stew boiling at the edge of the sky was somehow no longer a sunrise, but a sunset instead. And it would mean he was on the wrong side of the island. But that was impossible. The strangest thing was that he didn't even realize that somebody had hit him with a sword till after it had happened. All he knew at first was that suddenly he'd lost his balance and his left arm was numb.
Shit,
he said. He staggered and caught himself with his good right hand on the cold turf. There was a man behind him, a large young man with a round, pale face and a goatee. The two of them were stuck together somehow. They were connected by a short, broad-bladed sword that was stuck in Quentin's collarbone, and the man was trying to wrench it out. What had saved him was this. Half of Quentin's collarbone was made of hardwood, put there by the centaurs to replace what Martin Chatwin had bitten out of him. The man with the sword, not knowing this, had unluckily chosen that side when he attempted to cut Quentin in half from behind.
"Son of a bitch!" Quentin said.
He didn't mean the man specifically. He didn't know who, or who, he meant. If he'd been thinking clearly, Quentin might have actually tried to win the tug-of-war over the sword, but in the moment he just wanted it out of him badly. They both did. Their interests were temporarily aligned. In a state of almost disembodied fear, Quentin reached up and gripped it with the opposite side hand. It cut his palm. The man planted a booted foot on Quentin's back and yanked the sword out with a grunt. They faced each other, both panting. The quietness of it was weird. Real fights happened without a soundtrack. The man was lightly armored, wearing some kind of blue livery, not even as old as Quentin. It felt strangely personal. There, alone in a clearing on a silent island, in a low-angle morning, evening, light, Quentin felt the you-ness of the man intensely. For an endless second they stared at each other, while Quentin, like everyone else who has ever faced a blade unarmed, made little fainting motions in either direction as if he were a defender and the man with the sword was going to try to cut past him to the basket. Just in case he lost that matchup, Quentin whispered the opening words to a spell, a Persian fainting charm. He could do it with one hand, which was lucky because he still couldn't feel his left. Rudely, the man didn't wait for him to finish. He advanced, cutting off Quentin's angles, then lunged appallingly fast, stabbing this time rather than chopping. Quentin twisted desperately to his right and away, but not quite far enough, because the sword cut into him. It was incredible that he hadn't made it. In his mind he was so absolutely sure he would make it, but instead the metal went right into his right side, through his clothes, and into his body. He twisted so far around that it went in from behind. At first the sensation was just strange, this hard, awkward presence taking up space where usually his body was, grinding against his ribs. Then it felt warm, almost pleasantly warm, then almost immediately hot, searing hot, as if the sword wasn't just sharp but glowing white from a forge. "Ah!" Quentin said under his breath, and he sucked air through his clenched teeth, exactly as if he'd cut himself chopping an onion. The man was obviously a soldier, but Quentin had never really thought about what that meant. He was a professional killer, efficient and businesslike. He had none of Bingle's elegance. He was like a baker, except instead of making bread, he made corpses, and he wanted to make Quentin into one. He wasn't even breathing hard. He jerked the sword out so he could go in again, right away, this time aiming for something more vital. Time to make the doughnuts. Quentin couldn't think.
"Ishik!"
he shouted. He snapped his fingers. It was just what came to him. It had been nagging at the back of his mind ever since the safe house. He'd gotten it right this time. Light flared between them in the clearing. Startled, the man fell back a step. He must have thought Quentin had hurt him somehow. It didn't take him long to figure out that he was all right, but it didn't take Quentin long to blurt out the Persian fainting charm, either. The man dropped his sword and fell forward onto the thin grass. Quentin stood there, panting and holding his side. Blood soaked his shirt. That was too close. Too close. He almost died. The pain was amazing, like a pulsing flare hanging there in the softening early evening, an evening star. Not looking, he couldn't have said with absolute confidence if the pain was even located inside his body. When it couldn't get any worse, he threw up. sour fish from last night's dinner. Then it got even worse than that. Gingerly, he took off his shirt, detaching it in one go from the wounded place, and ripped off one of the sleeves. He folded the sleeve into a pad and pressed it against the wound, then tried as best he could to tie the rest of the shirt around him to hold it in place. When it was done, he spent a minute just gritting his teeth and trying not to pass out. His heart was fluttering in his chest like a trapped sparrow. He kept repeating the phrase, "Damage control," under his breath. It helped for some reason. When he could inspect it again, he saw that the wound was bleeding but not pumping blood. There seemed to be a sharp limit to how deep a breath he could take without his vision going gray with pain. He tried to think what was in there. From the pain when he moved, the sword must have cut muscle, but it couldn't have reached his lung. Could it? What the hell else was over there? Probably it had just gone into the flank meat. Adrenaline was flooding his system, dimming the pulsing flare of pain, pulling oxygen away from it. It was there, but he started to be able to bear it. As he did, he realized what was happening. It dawned on him with a terrible, fiery power. He was having an adventure. A real one this time. That's what the pain was. He looked at his hands. He could feel his left one again. He made fists with both of them. There was a chunky notch in his wooden collarbone, but no deep structural damage. The kind of thing you'd fill in with Bondo. He shook his head. It seemed clear, or clear-ish. He looked at the man snoring face down on the stubby island grass. He picked up his sword and began walking in the direction the man had come from. The castle was a small three-part affair, a stodgy, boxy keep with two outlying watchtowers, all built out of gray stone, with enormous trees growing around them. The whole layout was visible from where he stood on the rocky hillside. It was built on a grassy knob of land at the foot of the hills that Quentin could now see dominated one coast of the island, screening the castle from other angles of view. No wonder he and the others had missed it. Quentin crept from rock to rock, keeping out of sight of whoever might be monitoring the hillside, zigzagging downhill toward the castle. He didn't meet any more soldiers. Maybe it had just been bad luck. Not wanting to push it, he picked his way down a rocky defile to the edge of the sea. He would approach by creeping along the shore. A narrow crust of rocky beach ran along it, barely enough to keep his feet dry. The sea lapped at it excitedly with dark, rapid wavelets. Quentin wasn't even thinking about what he was doing. If he had to explain it to anybody, that he was preparing a one-man, die-hard, magical assault on a castle, it would have been difficult to justify. He might have said that he was performing vital reconnaissance, probing its defenses, but all that meant was that if he got scared enough, he was going to run away. What he was really thinking was that this was what Ember had meant, what Ember had given him, his chance. Something was in there, something to do with the keys, or Jollibee, or Julia, or all of them, and he was going to get it and bring it back. And then he stopped. A boat was drawn up on the thin shingled beach, a gray, weathered rowboat. The oars were there, laid neatly inside it like the folded wings of a dragonfly. It was in good repair. The painter was knotted around an overhanging branch. Just like that, Quentin got stuck, mentally stuck. It felt like no force on earth could compel him to walk past the boat without getting in it. He was going to get into it and retreat. He would row back around to the other side of the island, to where his friends were. His sword wound would compromise his rowing ability, but not fatally. The sudden sense of inertia was overwhelming. No one could reproach him for cowardice. Indeed, it would be foolhardy to keep going, selfish even. He was actually untying the thin rope from the tree branch. He had to do it with his left hand, since he couldn't lift his right arm above his head. When a pale face appeared at the far end of the beach, another soldier. It was eerie how long it took them both to react. Quentin didn't want to believe that the man could see him, or if he did, that he would recognize Quentin as an intruder. But even though